Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast in hours two. I am your co-host, the currently seasonally depressed Pisces, and this is my co-host.
I'm Aaron.
And are you seasonally depressed?
No, I'm just sort of always depressed.
So. Oh, well, that's fair. I think that these are dark times, quite literally, that we're living in. So what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about Interview with the Vampire, but which Interview with the Vampire are we talking about? Because there are so many.
Well, this week we're going to be talking about the new AMC series, which is obviously a new retelling of the traditional Anne Rice story, which pairs nicely with our episode of a couple weeks ago, which was, of course, the 94 film. So, because we already talked about the plot of the novel extensively back then, I don't think we need to rehash the plot too much for this iteration of the story. It is worth pointing out that there's going to be a Lives of the Mayfair Witches too, apparently. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be there's like some kind of dark universe, I think, or whatever, whatever brand they're using anyway. So anyway, this story obviously is the same narrative of Interview with the Vampire with a few notable twists. Most importantly, I think, Louis is
a vampire.
And?
Well, not a real one, because they're not real. He's played by an actor.
Don't let Aaron fool you. He's being very coy. In this iteration of the story, Louis is no longer an antebellum slave owner and plantation owner, but instead a black gay man living in the Jim Crow South.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is an interesting take and a refreshing change. I mean, obviously, it's a bit shuffling of the lore, but I think that's to the story's benefit. Because as the creator said, like, nobody wants to hear a story about a slave owner in 2022, which mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of validity to that.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I feel like it was a really nice update, because for me, it didn't just feel sort of like, oh, let's just change this just for the sake of changing it. It kept enough of the original spirit of the original story because it's still set in the past. Right. So you get to bring in a lot of historical themes and all that kind of stuff. But I think you're right. I think it was a smart move to make it not just one more retelling of sort of slave history.
Right,
but
exactly.
To focus on something else that we don't talk about quite as much.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I think the casting is spot on in this case. Louis, in this instance, is played by Jacob Anderson, most famous, to most television viewers as Grey Worm, the very taciturn and terse and ever loyal and faithful Grey Worm, the mercenary captain for most of the series run. I mean, I think, and he's also a singer. I don't know if you knew that, but he's also like a musical artist, which is interesting. So I think that he brings out some new layers and complexities of Louis's character. And what I found surprising, actually, was how loyal he is to the portrayal of Louis as we see in the novel. Mm-hmm. But luckily, he jettisons most of the whining and, the self-flagellation that is sort of the key attribute of Louis.
What are you talking about? Louis is, he's the strong, silent okay, not at all. I'm
not
sorry. I couldn't even finish that
sentence.
Couldn't
even get that. So, as listeners know from my talking about Louis last week, I am in no way a member of Team Louis. But I think that what Jacob Anderson does is really give us, a tortured mortal in the same way that Louis was tortured and, Brad Pitt's telling it in the novel, but his torture comes less from, the kind of sad young man of Anne Rice, more to a young gay black man living in the Jim Crow South.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the end point is the same, but how we get there is somewhat different.
Okay.
And I like that. I think that I really was, I mean, I'm not one of those people who cares whether they recast someone as a person of color that was a traditionally white role. I just don't care that much. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing in the aggregate, but I'm not one of the, the haters that get on the internet movie database and bitch about it endlessly.
Yeah.
But I was really just kind of blown away by how adeptly Jacob Anderson sort of embodied this role.
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of it?
I didn't even think about it that much. I just like the fact that they're black and brown vampires in this, simply put, because why not? I don't think they even need much more explanation than that. That's what I like about it, is that there isn't some attempt to try to explain why the shift. They just sort of tell the story in the new venue and with the new characters, and that's it.
Right. I mean, so it is worth pointing out, I'm glad you said the new venue, because the conceit of this show is that, in fact, the earlier interview that takes place between Daniel Malloy and Louis was in the 70s, and now Daniel, having been, you know, aged several decades and now suffering from Parkinson's, is invited by Louis to get the real story. So, which is an interesting conceit, and it's kind of it's in indirect conversation with both the original novel, but also with the 94 film, which I think is, there's a fun sort of intertextuality that I think really helps ground this show.
Yeah.
That I think is a wink and a nod to those of us who are, have been very sort of embedded within the Anne Rice fandom community in one way or another.
Exactly. And what the, I think for me the update does is that it sort of gave me an automatic reason to want to tune in despite having already read and seen a version of the movie so many times before, that stuff would have to be different given the updated time. It couldn't just be sort of a direct recycling. Right. Of the source material, there had to be changes throughout, which as a fan, I wanted to see what would be done with this great story that I've liked for so long.
Right. And I mean, because I think one of the things that Rice's original novels do so well is to explore deep philosophical questions. Like that's sort of the, to put it bluntly, her vampires are tortured philosophers. Like because of the fact that the very fact that they're immortal, they spend much of their time, aside from feasting on humans, like debating with themselves and with each other what it means to be immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, obviously that gives them a sort of, if you'll pardon the academic expression, a long durée kind of perspective on history writ large of humanity, which obviously is a little more contained in this show because Louis's not nearly as old as his literary counterpart, but it does still sort of give him a perspective on human development that is interesting and that, you know, is in keeping with, I think, the sort of ethos of the night, of the Vampire Chronicles writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, to that end, you know, he's able to have that perspective on human culture because even though he's a very powerful vampire, he still has to contend with the ugliness of racism in the U.S. That was not the case in the literary version,
right,
where race was kind of just sort of bracketed out. Like, it wasn't ever really brought up explicitly, at least not in this series. Not as much as, say, like, in The Mayfair Witches or some of the other work that Rand Rice did. So I appreciate that. And, I mean, it's also worth pointing out to those who were, like, bitching endlessly about Louis' recasting, it's not as if Anne Rice didn't engage with questions of race and blackness in her other books. Like, I'm thinking of The Feast of All Souls, or All Saints, or whichever it is, which is about the free people of color. So, like, if you're familiar with the Anne Rice oeuvre, like, it's entirely in keeping to bring that into this new adaptation.
Yeah.
Like, it feels true to the spirit of Anne Rice as the author, if that's what we want out of an adaptation. And I think that's valid, and I think that's one of the things the series does quite well.
I concur.
I mean, it's not that Louis is a free person of color, but that's adjacent, sort of, you know, because there is the implication that his grandfather was, I think, or his father or something like that.
Yes.
So, obviously, like I said, I think that Jacob Anderson deserves a lot of credit for the way he brings out some layers and complexities to Louis that is nice to see. Because, I mean, certainly, if you love vampire fiction, then you're sort of, in one way or another, a fan of sad boys, to use the parlance of the internet. Yes. And, I mean, Louis is kind of like the sad boy par excellence. And, I mean, there is that with Louis, like, with Jacob Anderson's Louis. Like, he's a deeply sensitive person. Obviously has had to live a double life because of living in the closet, but also being a notorious pimp in New Orleans. And we, you know, we get all of that, but we also see that he is yearning for love and fulfillment in the same way that his literary counterpart does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's to Anderson's credit that he's able to bring that out while also not getting too self-indulgent, which, you know, Louis tends to do as a character. And I think Brad Pitt brings that out with, in his interpretation of the character. Mm-hmm. So I think that I like seeing what Anderson was able to do to give us a stronger Louis and one who isn't nearly as painful to listen to for 7 hours,
right?
Roughly.
Yes. Yeah, but in there, I mean, I agree with everything you just said, but there's something you said that we should get back to. You said living in the closet in reference to Louis in the new version of the story. What are you getting at there?
Oh, well, in this version, one of the other notable changes is that Louis is explicitly discussed as a gay man. His relationship with Lestat, which we'll get to in a moment, is explicitly queer. They actually make out and have sex and all those things, which obviously are alluded to in the original version. And I think that in Rice's novel, it's still quote-unquote subtext. I'm still on the fence about whether I think it's actually subtextual in Anne Rice, like, because mm-hmm. he's very explicit that he loves Lestat in the book, but now we get some order actual physical conservation yeah. in a way that was, as we talked about last week, was not nearly the case in the 94 version, where it was like this close, you can't see me, but I'm making the finger and thumb together, this close, but never quite getting over the line. Now we get over the line and then some.
Exactly.
Because, you know, and it's very clear just from the very first meeting that Louis and Lestat share with each other that, you know, there's a physical chemistry there. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a real pleasure to see. And I keep, you know, I can't help but think of what the, you know, the 16-year-old me would have imagined or felt like seeing Louis and Lestat actually being lovers as opposed to just kind of the tortured whatever they are in the novel.
I think your brain would have exploded.
I probably would have. I think that's probably not the only thing that would have exploded.
Wow.
The listeners of Queens of the Bees are, that's pretty tame compared to some of the other things that I've said on this podcast, or that you have said, or that Mark, my former co-host, said, or that Jarell has said. Anyway, I digress. So what do you make of the fact that it's now an explicitly queer show as opposed to sort of the tap dancing around it that we saw in the 94 version?
I think that it helps it to sort of occupy, for me, a really similar place in the cultural imagination right now that the movie did in its time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to keep it sort of subtextually queer today would feel too regressive. It'd feel a little too backwards.
Right.
I think making it explicitly queer puts it where the towing the line put the original movie.
Yes, because I think that, you know, obviously this is a very different world than it was 30 years ago. Oh, that pains me to say that 94 was almost 30 years ago. That is a very painful thing. I'm going to need a moment to kind of wrap myself around that idea. But anyway, I think that this is a very different cultural milieu in which Interview is emerging. And so, like, there isn't as much risk entailed with telling explicitly queer stories as there would have been 30 years ago. It's also worth pointing out that this is TV and not film. Like, I'm not convinced that a new cinematic adaptation of Interview would have been as explicitly queer, but I do think that the kind of leeway that premium cable in particular gets when it comes to representation gives it the liberty to be able to make this kind of change and to tell this kind of story in a way that's not restricted as much as, say, the blockbuster Hollywood mentality that still dominates a lot of Hollywood filmmaking.
Yeah.
I mean, even now, you know, there are vanishingly few queer-centric stories, vampiric or otherwise, in Hollywood. As we talked about with Bros a couple of weeks ago, we may not get any for a while.
Yeah.
And so, but I do think that, you know, since it's on AMC, I think and since it does have a sort of, like, larger temporal palette to play with, that gives it some leeway to engage with the actual queer elements of this story.
Exactly.
So let's talk about Lestat. Like, I know this is Louis' story, and it is still, you know, the same things I said about the original 94 version and the novel in my discussion of that pertains here too. And I've been talking about this with a lot of my friends who have been watching the show and commenting on Lestat and how awful he is. And the truth is that this is still Louis' story. Like, I mean, I know he's claiming to Daniel Malloy, who's played by Eric Bogosian, that this is the real story. This is the, you know, the unvarnished truth and all its ugliness. But I still am not quite convinced that Louis doesn't still have a motivation for twisting at least some elements of the story so that he comes out the hero of his own melodrama.
Well, of course.
Yeah. Like, and so I think that I just want to foreground that before we get into Lestat and how he's portrayed in this series and how that compares to, obviously, inevitably, to the Tom Cruise version. Because I think that as great as Brad Pitt was as Louis, it seems to me that Tom Cruise was the bigger star at the time. Mm-hmm. So his star text sort of still overwhelms the Lestat in the public imaginary in a way that Brad Pitt doesn't with Louis. So I think that Jacob Anderson had the easier task of inhabiting Louis, because Louis is such a more amorphous character.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, Tom Cruise sort of still is the Lestat to overcome. We won't speak about Stuart Townsend from The Queen of the Damned. That's just, we just don't talk about that. So it seems to me that Sam Reed had the bigger shoes to fill, and his job was doubly complicated because, unlike Jacob Anderson, who at least had one big role on his resume, I mean, Sam Reed has been in many things, but he's not really a household name.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
whatever, even if you didn't know Jacob Anderson's name, you knew him as Grey Worm, I would be hard pressed to say what anyone might have been familiar with Tambourine before this, which makes his performance, to my mind, all the more extraordinary. Because from the moment that I saw him, I was like, oh my God.
Yep.
This is Lestat.
Exactly.
I was completely blown out of the water. I just could not believe how completely he inhabited the Lestat that I have known for the last 30 years.
Exactly. It's, to me, it's like the perfect updated, shifted homage to the original. There's enough channeling of the version of Lestat that we all remember that it doesn't feel strange, to me at least, as a viewer, to see this new version, despite all of the different directions that Reed's gone with his performance. And I think he absolutely nailed it.
Yeah. I mean, so one thing that strikes me, at least from the get-go, is his voice. Like, there's a rich, deep, mellifluous tone to his voice. Now, say many things about Tom Cruise. His voice is not particularly, like, rich or mellifluous. It's very shrill, actually. Which is not a problem. I'm just pointing out that, like, there's a very difference, like, in their vocal quality that immediately sort of establishes this Lestat as a much more explicitly sexual figure. Because there is something really sexy about Sam Reed's voice. And it's not just how the rich depth of it. It's also, like, the French affectedness of it. Yes. Now, whether how accurate of a French accent it is beside the point, frankly.
Well, it's New Orleans French. So.
Right, which, I mean, you know, I mean, Lestat is French. Like, he's from France. But, it, you know, I'll grant, I suspect maybe a New Orleans French is easier to for an Aussie, which Sam Reed is Australian, to adopt than a traditional French one.
Yeah.
But even so, like, to this untrained Philistine American, it sounds very French. And I think that that's so key to Lestat's persona and who he is as an individual. It's nice to see that on screen as opposed to Tom Cruise, who doesn't even try to sound French. And I mean, quite honestly, I probably would have laughed if Tom Cruise had tried to sound French.
Right.
But Sam Reed just so effortlessly slides into that vernacular that I believe that I could believe this is a dissipated French aristocrat come to live in New Orleans.
Yes, yes.
But it's more than that. Like, there's a sort of sinister hauteur, but also a brooding sexuality
about him
that is pitch perfect for the kind of person that Lestat is.
Right. And I feel like wearing the sexuality on his sleeve the way he does, I think, is also important. And also, I think it pushes the show up to the point where I think the movie again did in the past, with the kind of weird flamboyantness, but that sort of sexuality brooding sort of under the surface with the movie. Here, it's not under the surface anymore. It's exploding out.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, I think is the right place for it to be for a series in 2022.
Right, and I mean, I like that you say flamboyance, because certainly, you know, Tom Cruise's Lestat is flamboyant, because I don't think you could be Tom Cruise and not be flamboyant. I'm not sure that Tom Cruise is capable of an understated performance. I just don't think that's who he is as a performer. And I mean, certainly, you know, this version of Lestat is flamboyant. He's flamboyant both in how he, like, walks down the street. Like, there's a, I don't want to call it a, there's kind of a cockiness just to the way that he moves through the space. In a way, he just sort of effortlessly commands the space, which, again, given that Sam Reed is not a star in the way that Tom Cruise is, so it's really quite extraordinary that he's able to capture that so effortlessly and to translate that into screen. Like, we see it anytime he walks into a room with a bunch of arrogant people, he's the one who kind of captures every eye. When he walks down the street, he draws every eye. Whenever he is trying to make apologies for Louis, which we'll get to the reason why he's trying to apologize to Louis, there's that flamboyance. He buys Louis a car and all this other stuff. So, and that's also in his eyes. Like,
yes,
it's not the same kind of frenzied craziness that we see in Tom Cruise's.
Exactly.
Which I'm not entirely sure isn't just Tom Cruise. There's a certain kind of intensity to Sam Reed's performance.
Yes.
That is not crazy. It's just really intense.
It's exactly. It's more almost languid at times. It's more like, it's like he sort of, it's like he's drawing you inward to him, unlike Cruise's Lestat. It's almost like, I'm going to overpower you.
Yes. I think that's a very good point. And I mean, that to me is more in keeping with the Lestat of the novel. Like, or at least I think the Lestat of the novel can do both. Like, he's sort of changes, he maybe we could say he code switches depending on who he's talking to. And I think that in this version, the romance between Lestat and Louis and their relationship and the reasons why Louis would continue to return to this relationship despite its obvious dysfunction makes more sense than what the Brad Pitt / Tom Cruise version did. Not because of anything those two did wrong, mm-hmm. but because both because this show is so much more explicitly queer and frames this relationship as one of actual physical desire, mm-hmm. but also because this Lestat, you can understand why someone would feel so drawn to them. Mm-hmm. Like, you would understand why someone would be, like, in lust and in love with them.
Right.
Because they're just so effortlessly charismatic mm-hmm. and beguiling. And I mean, that's not to wax too. Ask Aaron. Every time that we would finish an episode, I'd be like, oh my God, this is Lestat. Like, yes. This is the extent to which I was completely smitten by this performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not exaggerating. Literally, after every episode.
And so, I like that. And I mean, I think that I feel as if, to return to what we were saying earlier, the series, you know, creators and people involved with the writing and in the performing are really kind of in bringing up the queerness and making it so explicit and having and staging Lestat and Louis as a couple, I think are giving kind of a gift to the queer people who have always kind of occupied the central core of the Anne Rice fandom. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is their gift to us.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, maybe that's why I respond to it so strongly, is because I feel like this is a validation of all of my years of slavishly adoring Anne Rice. Like, finally, someone gets it. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't Anne Rice has filtered through Hollywood. I mean, it is in a very real sense, obviously. But it's not Anne Rice filtered through the powers that be at Hollywood that don't want to offend anyone.
Exactly.
This is filtered through people who actually get what she was trying to do.
Yes, yes.
And I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, I appreciate the risks that they're willing to take with this kind of story.
Yeah, me too. It's frankly not what I expected. I don't think if you would ask teenage me back when the movie came out, would there be a future for this that would push us even further in terms of the kind of representation that you're talking about. I would have been like, nope, I don't think such a thing would ever happen. But here we are.
Yes, in the year of our Lord, 2022, here we are indeed. So let's dive a little bit deeper into the Louis Lestat relationship, because I think that there's been a lot of commentary about it for good reasons, because I think that as in the novel, as in the movie version, this version doesn't shy away from some of the uglier aspects. You know, we've talked a little bit so far about how beautiful they are and how much we love them being in love with each other and mm-hmm. how much they are, you know, smitten with one another. There is also a darker side to their relationship, which is true of the novel.
Yeah, so let's get it out of the way now. They shack up without benefit of marriage.
That is true. They do shack up without benefit of marriage. And of course, you know, one way of getting into this is to talk about Claudia, because yes. that's the wild card. So for a while, Louis and Lestat, as they do in the novel, live a life of, you know, preying on people. Louis, of course, feels his usual angst about feeding on people, so has to eat rats. I know how to find you, Louis. Just follow the trail of rats, as Tom Cruise says in the movie. There's no line quite like that in this. Although there is a restaging of the kill them, you are a killer, Louis. There is a similar moment in mm-hmm. this version. But I feel like with Jacob Anderson's version, interpretation of Louis, it's not quite as self-indulgent. Like, I don't feel like, oh my God, Louis, get over yourself.
So right.
I don't feel quite that sense. Like, because we have seen a little bit more of Louis' relationships with his family in particular. So there's no bullshit heterosexualizing him like in the movie version. Mm-hmm. Like, now we get to see his dynamic with his sister, with his mother, with his brother who takes his own life by jumping off a roof. So we get a sense of Louis as a human mm-hmm. and as a person. So his angst and his guilt about taking life feels more authentic.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than just sort of the...
Yeah, because we see he's got real shit he's been dealing with. So it's not like, oh, just poor me, because.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in that sense, like, you know, to draw a comparison, like, in the movie version, Louis' lust for death is related through exposition. Like, we learned that his wife and son died, mm-hmm. or child died. Here, we actually get to see him on the roof with his brother, who then takes his own life. So there's an immediacy. We as viewers understand why mm-hmm. Louis would give up his life so easily to become a vampire. Mm-hmm. And that also, by extension, helps to explain why he's so guilt-ridden about taking human life.
Exactly.
That feels more earned narratively mm-hmm. than it does.
Yes.
Even I would argue in the novel. And so, you know, he obviously feels this compunction about taking life, but there are moments when he does kind of lash out in rage. Like, for example, he does take the life of one of the notoriously racist aldermen of New Orleans, mm-hmm. and then impales his body on the door of his mansion.
Yes.
Or no, it's not. It's anyway, it's not important where it is. But which, of course, ignites the race riot, which then burns down basically Louis's neighborhood, and that's what orphans Claudia, oh, yeah. not mm-hmm. the plague. And so he rescues Claudia. Lestat makes her into a vampire, and that's the sort of wrench in their already vexed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get too much further into the Louis Lestat relationship, maybe we could talk a little bit about Claudia. Yeah,
exactly.
Who is aged up in this version. Like, yes, she's
thankfully.
Yes. She's what, 14?
Something 16? Like that.
So, yeah, she's a young teenager at the time. So, and I think that, you know, she has played very capably. I mean, I'm going to admit that I'm still on team Kirsten for this role. Like, I still think that Kirsten Dunst captures the Claudia of the novel. But that being said, I do think that the actress who plays, you know, this new version of the character does a very good job. And her name is Bailey Bass. And so I think that she deserves a lot of credit for giving us a newer version of this character than what we saw in the 92 version. Mm-hmm. And one that I think of the three is the most different.
Yes.
Than what we saw before.
Exactly. Well, she has to be, because even though it's just a few years of difference in age, those little things matter. It's the same reason why in the movie they age up Claudia from the book, where she's, what, 5 in the book?
Yeah.
But getting her in this new version to be a young teenager closes off certain kinds of ways in which you can take that character that right. would make sense, and the kinds of frustrations that she would have and how they would be performed by making her someone sort of on the cusp of womanhood.
Right.
It lends a different feeling to the kind of angst that Claudia has right. as time goes by that I think is easier to watch on screen.
I agree with you. I mean, there's always been something. I mean, I think that the child version of Claudia, whether it's the 5-year-old of the novel or the 9-10-year-old of the movie, is genuinely horrifying. Like, there's mm-hmm. something horrifying about a child being a vampire, but also, like, when you really dive deep into how awful it must have been for Claudia, the person,
mm-hmm.
to be trapped in a child body for eternity is yeah. a terrible thing.
Exactly.
A truly horrible thing.
Right.
And so that's, as you say, like, is very unsettling to sort of sit with as a viewer. And I appreciate, though, that this Claudia has similar questions, but they're reframed around desire, mm-hmm. like of a different sort. Like, because obviously, you know, she can never be a fully adult human but she's so much closer to that than the child version is,
yes.
which in some ways makes it even worse
right.
for her to be so close to attaining the fulfillment of being an adult and all that comes with it,
mm-hmm.
including most notably sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but to have that always thwarted is a truly kind of like purgatorial existence.
Yeah. It's, you know, that's rough. And I like that they're able to show that more explicitly here, because that same undercurrent is there in the other portrayals of Claudia, but it's so much more horrifying that they have to be far more subtle
right.
the younger that Claudia is.
Right. Exactly. I mean, because in the movie version, as we talked about, like, the horror comes when the most horrifying moment is when she cuts her hair
mm-hmm.
and she realizes that it'll never change.
Exactly.
Like, that's the sort of crowning climax for her, is where she's like, oh my god, I'm never going to ever change. Whereas for this Claudia, sort of like her crisis moment is when she has a like a brief fling with a human who then she accidentally kills.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is like sort of her not come to Jesus moment, but it is the moment where like that crystallizes for her how much she will never have the fulfillment that she yearns for.
Yeah.
She will always be the third variable in the Louis Lestat relationship.
Exactly.
And it's her role as the sort of third point of that triangle that causes mm-hmm. her so much anger, because she knows she can never be for Louis what Lestat is.
Yeah.
But she can never have it with anyone else either, because she's, you know,
mm-hmm.
never a fully human.
Exactly. And I love how they try to resolve that whole family situation with, again, Louis and Lestat being obviously explicitly a couple. They function explicitly as these parental figures to Claudia when they take her in. But as she sort of reckons with this, you know, eternal life, learning you know, basically becoming a woman inside, but still being, you know, again, on the cusp of womanhood physically. She says she wants to renegotiate. She's no longer their kid. She's Louis's sister.
Mm-hmm.
Like, then that's an important shift for her, that she'd be seen in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least that allows her some sense of growth.
Right.
And that's very important for her. That's one of the things that's required for her to stay.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things she insists on.
Right. And I mean, it's very clear from, like, the way that these characters are staged that Louis and Claudia can hear one another telepathically, whereas, mm-hmm. you know, and this is in keeping with Rice's mythos, like, Makers and their progeny can't hear each other, like,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason, that's just not they're not capable of doing that, and so there's always so it's complicated. Like, that's what I really appreciate this, and that's what I think a 7-episode TV series can really get into,
mm-hmm.
is how complicated that really makes their dynamics, because just as there's a relationship that Louis and Lestat share that Claudia can never partake in, in much the same way, Louis and Claudia
mm-hmm.
can correspond and relate to one another in a way that Lestat never can.
Exactly.
And it makes Lestat really, really, mm-hmm. really, really, really mad.
Yes. Really, really, really jealous.
Yes. And I mean, that's one thing I think Sam Reed does really well, is to show just how capricious Lestat can be. Like, mm-hmm. the novel version, at least as Louis tells it, of Lestat is very notoriously fickle mm-hmm. and changeable. And, you know, obviously he's quite thoroughly smitten with Louis, which makes his jealousy of Claudia all the more understandable
mm-hmm.
and believable when he has these kind of outbursts of rage. I mean, again, they have an intensity to them that feels different than, like, Lestat's shrieking in Tom Cruise's version,
mm-hmm.
which is just very Tom Cruise-like. I mean, yes. he just has this way of conveying temper tantrums. With Sam Reed's Lestat, it feels like jealousy and heartbreak and rage all bundled mm-hmm. into one,
yes.
and which is obviously driven by Eros, like his like mm-hmm. actual love for Louis. And I love those moments when he just like lashes out at Claudia, like when they're playing chess and he throws the chessboard,
mm-hmm.
or there's other moments when he kind of just lashes out at her, because obviously the only reason he made her a vampire, as was the case with the novel too, is to keep Louis with him,
because mm-hmm.
he needed something to anchor yeah. Louis that he could not yeah, provide.
You have a baby to save the marriage.
Yes, exactly. And so, but obviously that doesn't work out quite as they intended.
Exactly.
Because, you know, in much the same way that we get in the previous two iterations, Claudia is the one who leads the revolt against Lestat and basically manipulates the very manipulatable Louis into trying to kill Lestat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I mean, one of the things that I think this show captures very well is like the physical intimacy aspect of it. Like, there's so many moments of physical intimacy between Lestat and Louis, like both pre being a vampire and post being a vampire, where we kind of like, you know, Louis sucks on Lestat's thumb. Like, I mean, it's really hot. I mean, I always think gay sex, when it's done well in movies, is really hot. I'm not just talking about porn. I'm talking about, like, you know, as I said with My Policeman, I find gay sex very hot when staged properly. And this show knows how to stage it.
Yes.
Which is what ultimately makes Louis' Lestat betrayal of Lestat all the more heartbreaking for him and for us.
Exactly. Like, because it seems like in the ways in which they work together, they work together.
Mm-hmm.
But the ways in which they don't, they just don't.
Right. I mean, because obviously, you know, the crux of the crisis comes when Lestat basically tries to kill Louis.
Like, mm-hmm.
he takes him up into the air and then drops him after having dragged him around the apartment and beat the living shit out of him. So mm-hmm. it's a deeply dysfunctional and abusive relationship, clearly. Mm-hmm. And that episode in particular, where Lestat drops Louis, raised a lot of ire among fans of the show who were perplexed by its graphic depiction of domestic violence. I was a little myself perplexed by the perplexity, because I have thought, what show have you been watching? Like,
right.
The psychological abuse has been there all along. The emotional mm-hmm. abuse has been there all along. It's been there in the novel. It's been there in the 94 right. version. Yes, Lestat dropping Louis is something that's not seen in earlier stories,
mm-hmm.
but it's not as if, like, Lestat isn't capable of these things.
Exactly.
And I mean, again, it's worth reiterating, this is Louis's telling.
Yeah.
And he needs to make sure that he comes out looking good.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, not every relationship in
our fiction is perfect. And in fact, there's a value sometimes to seeing these uglinesses to make us think critically about how they manifest in the real world.
Right.
And so it's all the more striking in that regard that Louis ends up forgiving Lestat eventually.
Yeah. And also just one thing I was going to add in there, one other consideration that other folks don't seem to be making with this, is that, yeah, this is a troubled relationship between two creatures that are essentially destined to kill. And so egregious violence occurring between them shouldn't be surprising anybody at all.
Right. And I mean, it's also worth pointing out that, like, and one key difference is that Lestat actually asks Louis for permission to make him a vampire, which is a really big change from the original text where it happens without his consent.
Yeah.
So that's an I just want to put that in there as well. But obviously Louis returns to Lestat, but Claudia can never really forgive Lestat either for having done such a thing to Louis or just for being who he is. Like, she just finds Lestat absolutely unbearable. And so, of course, she, you know, manufactures this whole plan to do away with him, which is, you know, what happens in the novel and the show, or sorry, the movie as well. And it's successful. She poisons him, you know, with dead blood. And then, but it's Louis this time who makes the killing blow, which is a very interesting change from the other versions of this story. What did you make of that change?
I liked it because it felt in keeping with this Louis being just throughout a more active character than Brad Pitt's Louis.
Right.
So again, I think it fit similarly in the story, which is why I think it worked so well.
Right. And I mean, there's so much I love because it's all staged as part of this Mardi Gras celebration. So like, you know, they're dressed up in this kind of the accoutrement of the Ancien Régime. Like, it's very, you know, pre-revolution France, which is a nice allusion to Lestat's own origins. And, you know, it's obviously heartbreaking for Louis to do this, but I think that it makes sense from his development as a character, because he can't be free of Lestat, but he can't live without him either. So it's kind of like the double bind of, you know, many of us have lived with at one point or another. And then, of course, the twist is that he deliberately leaves Lestat alive. Or because Claudia wants them to burn Lestat's body, which is what they do with the other new fledgling that Lestat has made. But Louis says, no, I can't do it. And so they leave him in a trunk for the garbage to be picked up. But as Daniel points out, in the present, you knew that Lestat was going to survive and eat rats and manage to come back. So that's, I thought, a really nice resolution to that particular arc. And that's how the series, the season ends. But I also think it clarifies something that I always was confused about in the books and in the show, the movie. Like, Lestat and Claudia, or Louis and Claudia, aren't idiots. They had to have known that, like, just cutting Lestat's throat isn't going to kill him.
Exactly.
Like, there's only a certain number of things that can kill a vampire.
Right.
In this mythology. So this makes sense. And as Daniel points out to Louis, it's like, you ultimately chose Claudia. Or sorry, you chose Lestat.
Right.
And so, like, I thought that was a nice touch to kind of, like, puncture Louis' own sense of, you know, self-justifying morality.
Right. I think it's not even just so much as self-justifying morality. It's him still not really reconciling the extent to which he truly was in love. And accepting that he really never let go. Like, having that's there, too.
Right. And, I mean, I really appreciate the way that this Daniel, you know, older, more jaundiced, more cynical, kind of constantly prods at Louis, which I think that is, it functions on two levels. One, it's more reflective of the cynical age in which we live. Like, we're just the more cynical people in 2022 than we were, arguably, in 75. We were pretty cynical in 75, too, but even more so now. But secondly, it also kind of, like, is a self-aware nudge to the for the show to point out how self-constructed this entire narrative is. And I think that that's brought up again and again. We see it, for example, when, you know, Daniel is handling Claudia's handwritten diaries, that we see, you know, we see it in these moments where he's like, I feel like you're bullshitting me, Louis. Like, I love those moments. And Eric Bogosian deserves so much credit for being able to bring out that element of Daniel that I don't think we get as much in the novel version.
No. I think that I feel like Louis and Daniel are in the new series are much more like peers, in terms of their powers. Like, obviously, as the vampire, Louis has all kinds of power. But Daniel is seasoned at this point. He's been around the block, and he knows what he's doing, and nothing's going to stop him. Unlike in the movie, when both Louis and Daniel are young in appearance, but of course, Louis is an old vampire with all kinds of power. Mm-hmm. But Daniel is more of a novice.
Right. Yeah, so there is a sense, as you say, like, that they're much more equal than they might have been in the past. Although, still, Louis is a very menacing figure here, mm-hmm. particularly as the series reaches, or the, not the series, the season reaches its conclusion, which brings us to the stunning revelation that mm-hmm. happens at the very last few moments. So, throughout the season, there's been this sort of nebulous figure called Rashid, because mm-hmm. this all takes place in one of the Gulf countries. And there's been this figure, Rashid, who kind of lingers in the background. And there's been a sense that Daniel doesn't quite trust him because he knows that something is off. Mm-hmm. You know, because he doesn't seem to know that much about Islam, for one.
Right.
And then it turns out that this is none other than Armand, mm-hmm. who, as we'll recall, was played by Antonio Banderas in the 94 version. And is a pretty ubiquitous figure, both in interview, but also in the Vampire Chronicles mm-hmm. more generally. And now it's revealed, as Louis says, this is Armand, the love of my life.
Right.
And I love it because it's very clear that this, the queer dynamic that was so prevalent with Lestat and Louis, has just been replicated because of the obvious command that even though Armand is much smaller physically than Louis, it's clear he has a tremendous hold on this younger vampire. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like sometimes Louis acts out and we have to look after him for his own good. So there is a sense in which Louis has just traded two other deeply dysfunctional relationships, one with Lestat and one with Claudia, mm-hmm. for a new one.
Right.
And so there's already a hint of another power dynamic. And obviously we know that Lestat is still alive. We know it because I can't imagine a Vampire Chronicles TV show that doesn't mm-hmm. have Lestat in future seasons. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing how this conflict between them plays out, especially because in the novel version, Lestat is painted as kind of this pitiable figure, mm-hmm. which I can imagine the Lestat that emerges in the later books being really pissed off about that. And I can likewise imagine the Lestat of this version being really pissed at being relegated to such a whiny role. Mm-hmm. So I'll be very curious to see how the future of this show kind of develops Lestat, and whether we see more of his point of view than what we've got so far.
Yeah, and I'm wanting to see what emerges of the love triangle that's going to have to be there.
Right.
Unless, you know, the next season goes in some completely ridiculous direction that we're not anticipating.
Right. And I mean, I will say that, you know, one of the things that I appreciated about this version of Interview with a Vampire is how, even though it makes a number of changes to the lore, to the characters to some degree, it felt true to the spirit that I have been familiar with all this mm-hmm. time. Like, in some ways, it felt more true to the spirit even than the 1994 version did. So I really love the allusions to the lore. Like, we have references to They Who Must Be Kept, which are obviously Ankasha and Ankiel, the sort of progenitor vampires. Mm-hmm. There's the allusions to the Cloud Gift. There's the allusions to the Theatre de Vampires, which is what, you know, reveals that this is Armand that we're talking to. Obviously, there are some liberties taken. Vampires don't have sex mm-hmm. in Anne Rice's universe, but they do in this one. Like, it's pretty clear that Lestat and Louis are actually banging. Like,
right.
They don't smoke mm-hmm. in Anne Rice's version. They smoke in this mm-hmm. one. They don't eat human food in Anne Rice, but they do here. But I don't care about those, really.
Also, the weirdest thing about them banging, though, is they bang, but they also consistently sleep in separate coffins. It was like, kind of like almost as sweet and pure as I Love Lucy, but then almost pornographic.
Right. But they also sometimes sleep in the same coffin.
Yeah.
So it just depends, I think. Mm-hmm. So all in all, I thought that the series did a very, very good job of not only like updating Rice's material for a new generation, but staying really true to the authentic spirit. And I don't think that you have to stay true to the spirit of a text to adapt it well. But I do think that staying true to the general ethos of a text makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. otherwise, why adapt?
You know? Exactly.
It's right. Like, why not just make something new? But I do feel that of all the things that I've seen of Anne Rice's works being adapted, this one comes closest, I think, to capturing the intangible essence of the Vampire Chronicles that I grew up loving. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So, I mean, thankfully, it was renewed for a second season already, even before it premiered.
Nice.
And so I think, you know, they understood they had tapped into something. There is a pretty vibrant
fan community for this show already. Like, I follow quite a few Twitter accounts that are very robustly loving of this. Like, one of my favorites is No Contextless Stat with Lion Court. It's you know, I appreciate the way that this show has already created its own fandom. I'm sure some of these people were already Anne Rice fans to start with, but I really love the way that it's creating a new fandom.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's, there's something really nice about that, especially for those of us who are, you know, are old hat or old hands at this. It's kind of nice. And to see people love these characters, but love the actors too. Like, there's been a real embrace of the actors themselves. And Jacob Anderson and Sam Reed have been very explicit about bringing out the queerness, why they did it that way, how they wanted to stay true to Anne Rice's vision. Like, they goof around and there's such obvious, like, chemistry between them. Like, I could go on and on about this for hours, but I just love how intimate this show feels. Like, that's exactly, that's what I feel. Like, there's an intimacy to its gay relationships, but also the way the cast engages with the material, but with the fandom. Like, I feel like there's just a purity to it that's just really nice and so rare to see. And so it allows me to kind of ignore the naysayers, because I think there's a really vibrant fan community that I really do like being a part of.
And I'll just add on, what I love about that is everything that you just said, all of that sort of warm, intimate talk that you said about the show, I feel all of that too. But what I love about it is that you can say all of that stuff about a show that, to me, is also a very technically well-made show. Because a lot of the kind of praise that you gave, people might say that about a show that's sort of, you know, not necessarily a big budget, big spectacle, but maybe just something that has a lot of heart. And, you know, we know what that means. That's nice for a show that maybe isn't all that great, but there's something you love about it. This is a genuinely a well-made show. But it also has that heart to it as well, which is why I think I loved it so much, because I tend to be a little bit more judgmental than TJ is sometimes. That is true. I love it as much as he did.
Which, I mean, I just need to reiterate, that is a huge thing. Like, that does not very often happen, that Aaron loves something as much as I do. And so it's really kind of validating. Because if Aaron loves it, then it must be really good. So I think that's about it for, I mean, we've had a pretty robust discussion of this of this series. And I can't wait to see season two. There's also a adaptation of The Mayfair Witches coming in January. So there's kind of a whole expanded cinematic universe or television universe for this that I'm very excited to see. My only regret is that Anne Rice passed away before she got to see this. Because I do truly think that Anne herself would have loved what has happened. Like, I feel like she would have appreciated what this show was able to accomplish.
Yes, we miss her. But are we sure she didn't turn herself into a vampire?
I am not sure about that. But hopefully Christopher, who is her, you know, her son, also a Pisces, also queer. I'm not saying that I, you know, feel a deep spiritual connection to Christopher Rice, but I do kind of feel a deep spiritual connection with Christopher Rice.
You are a Christopher Rice.
I wish. I hope that he also, like, is getting as much joy out of this as we do. All right, well, stay tuned, and we'll be right back to do a little gay service announcement. All right, well, here we are. We're back. Sorry, I meant to say PS Gay. I forgot that was the brand. We've got to stay consistent with our brand identity. That's the thing with 21st century. We've got to stay on brand. So today's the PSK, unfortunately a rather somber one. I did not intend for this to be the tenor of our discussion today, but I feel like I can't do a recording today without giving acknowledgement, first of all, to those who lost their lives in the recent gay club shooting in Colorado Springs, but also just sort of acknowledging how difficult this moment is. It doesn't seem, at least, to have been quite the extent of Pulse, which was arguably one of the greatest, like, or most terrible gay tragedies of the 21st century so far. But already 5 people are dead, and I think 20-odd are injured. And we are not, I'm not 100% sure, I don't want to jump the gun. I do think that evidence points that it was, in fact, a hate crime. Like, it was motivated by actual anti-LGBTQ sentiment. But even if it wasn't, the same holds true as what I said about Pulse, which, regardless of the motivations, it does reveal how dangerous and how precarious queer life remains in 2022. Like, I think that if nothing else brings that home, these kinds of incidents really remind us of that. But I also want to point out that you can't, detach these moments of violence and tragedy from the increasingly strident efforts of the GOP to paint queer people as groomers, as sexual predators and so forth. Like, I don't think that that's an accident that we saw this kind of violence.
Yeah, not at all. And you also, just briefly, you also can't separate it from the larger trend of mass shootings that happen in this country all of the time anyway.
Right. I mean, because there's so much going on with, you know, with this moment. As you say, like, we live in a country that is always under the specter of gun violence. And I mean, it's kind of astounding that so many people's lives have been sacrificed on the altar of, you know, the gun fetish that seems to be so much a part of this country's DNA. I mean, I'm from West Virginia, and that doesn't make any sense to me. But trust me, I mean, guns are like the national tool, or sorry, the state tool of West Virginia, basically. Right. And I don't understand it. But it's also, like, it can't, like, it, you know, it's impossible to overstate how hysterical the GOP has become in the lead-up to this moment. Like, once they realized that they were losing on gay marriage, they decided that they were going to lean in to the groomer rhetoric. We see it in the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida. We see it all over this country. And then for Lauren Boebert to get onto Twitter and say, you know, express her heartfelt sympathy and outrage that's happened. It's like, you can fuck off, because you are one of the chief perpetrators of this kind of damaging rhetoric that encourages a very already radicalized right-wing segment of the population to see queer people as a threat. What do you think is going to happen? And so I think there needs to be, will there be? I don't think so, but there needs to be a soul-searching among Republican elected leaders of what their rhetoric creates, because they tend to insulate themselves from criticism by making the disingenuous claim that it's just speech, or I'm just pointing out, or I'm asking questions or whatever, without recognizing or refusing to acknowledge the impact that public statements like that have on impressionable members of the public, particularly a gun fetishist public, many of whom tend to be socially conservative. Like, you know that this, you're reaping the whirlwind. And I find it just deeply, actually infuriating, quite frankly, that this is what's going to happen. And so I do mean, what can we do? Like, that's the question that always kind of, like, you know, is the corollary to this. Stop voting for Republicans. That's that would be my prescription. Because whether or not there are moderate Republicans, is, which there are, obviously, is kind of beside the point. Because they will never stand up to the right-wing, more zealous element of their party, who will continue to demonize drag brunches, drag shows, all the kind of people that they paint as other or, you know, whatever. And I don't think that they're ever going, the center of that party is never going to grow enough of a spine to challenge the more zealous wing ever. They never have, and they never will, because they know that that's the kind of people that it drives to the polls. And they can always use gay people or queer people, not just gay people, but trans people in particular, as their punching bags. And then they act surprised whenever violence happens. And I find it, like I said, if you want my advice about what you should do, don't be a Republican who votes for Republican. Or for, don't be a gay person who votes for Republican.
Don't be any person who votes for
Republican. Well, yes. I'm sure that to all of our straight friends out there, I'm sure we do have some straight listeners. Please also, that's also a point worth reiterating, particularly in the aftermath of the election, is that if you consider yourself an ally, then you need to remember that your votes matter. Like, I mean, I think there's also an important way in which many Americans kind of distance themselves from their votes. They're like, well, I just voted for blah, blah, blah because of blah. No, like, if you want to claim that you're an ally, if you want to claim that you love the queer people in your life, then you can't enable the kind of people who put their lives at risk, whether by actually being part of the right wing or by turning a blind eye to it, which many people do. And so, I mean, if I hate the fact that shootings like what happened at Colorado Springs feel inevitable. But if we're going to make their lives mean something, and I don't want to suggest that they're sort of like necessary victims, because they're not. That's why it's so aggravating, is because it's not necessary. But if we want to make their lives mean something rather than just another senseless act of gun violence, then we have to do something to change it so that that doesn't keep happening.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry, there's just no, I can't imagine at this point a Republican Party, particularly not one that's going to be led by Kevin McCarthy in the House, is ever going to do anything to either discipline those who espouse this horrible homophobic, transphobic ideology,
or the ones who are gun nuts. Like, they're just not going to stand up to it. And so I don't think that, you know, we have any choice but to just not vote for them.
Exactly. And they're really not going to ever examine the significant overlap between those two groups that you just mentioned.
Right. So, I mean, you know, is that going to be the cure-all? No. But, you know, it's either that or we just throw up our hands and just admit to a sense of powerlessness, and I will, for one, just refuse to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you want to memorialize those who have passed, you know, either in Pulse or, you know, at Colorado Springs, then make their deaths mean something so that they're not just another group of sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that I've exhausted myself from my soapbox... We'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to give our social media channels. All right, well, thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in for another great episode of Queens of the Bees. I know we've been a bit, let me rephrase that. I have been a bit inconsistent with releasing our episodes. I promise you, we will be back on track, even though it's the holidays, but we have a whole slate of fun Christmas stuff coming up throughout the month of December, so we'll be sharing lots of Christmas cheer. I'm a Christmas gay. I don't know that Aaron is really a Christmas gay per se, but I am one of those kinds, so we'll be having lots of that kind of fun. Now, Aaron, should I even bother asking you about your social medias or no?
I mean, you can ask. You can always ask.
It would be an exercise in futility. It would be much like voting for Republicans. It would be an exercise in futility. So I won't bother with that. But if you want to follow me on social media, you can follow me on Twitter for the moment until it completely falls apart at TJ Weston, the number 3. You can also follow me on Instagram at Thomas Weston, the number 3. So far, anyway, Instagram isn't falling apart, so we'll just have to hope for the best. You got to pick your evil billionaire whose social media platform you're going to use. I guess that's really the kind of world we live in. You can also follow the Queens of the Bees Instagram at Queens of the Bees, which reads out as Queens of the BS. I'm sorry. There's no way to avoid it, unfortunately. There's no apostrophes in Instagram handles, for better or worse, where we will both post little bite-sized reviews of the movies and shows that we watch here, but also things that are not necessarily queer-related. We do watch things that aren't queer-related,
Every once in a while. Yeah.
So we'll be posting little snippets. Occasionally, we'll have a little bit of queer screen history thrown in there to sort of leaven things up a little bit. And, of course, you can also follow me over on Substack, where I have a newsletter, Omnivorous, where I do write about gay stuff, as well as more general cultural and political commentary. So if you're not tired of hearing me ramble on about everything here in podcast land, you can also read me. So I would love that. But, of course, I must also remind everyone to, if you have a chance, please go and rate or review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. As I never get tired of mentioning that, you know, we are still a very small podcast, so every little bit of visibility that we get is for the best. Certainly, the more reviews and ratings that we get, the easier it is to find us for those who might also want to hear about our ramblings about queer pop culture. Now, I will say that I prefer positive reviews. So if you have something negative to say, make sure you preface it by saying to Aaron specifically.
If I can take it.
He can take the criticism. He will feed it back to me in a more digestible, less offensive form. But if you have positive, glowing things to say, then by all means, address it to me. So as always, we do want to thank every one of you who tunes in to listen to us. We do truly appreciate you all. And we do look forward to connecting with you on social media or just, you know, knowing that you're out there listening to us. It really does mean a lot. So, we'll be back with you next week to talk about American Horror Story NYC. So, for Queens of the Bees, I am TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we'll talk to you next week.